Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, a modern history of nations in crisis and how they rose to the occasion or buckled under the pressure. We'll spend this hour with Jared Diamond, the geographer who wrote the influential Guns, Germs, and Steel and Collapse. His latest book draws fascinating parallels between the skills that help individuals cope with trauma and the tough choices countries must make to preserve their autonomy and shared values when the unthinkable happens. We'll talk about how tiny Finland fended off the Soviet Union, how Australia pivoted away from the influence of the UK, and how our experience with national crises might shape our success or failure at coping with global problems like pandemics and climate change. Our conversation starts after a short break. You know where Finland is, right? It shares more than 800 miles of its eastern border with what is now Russia. In 1939, the Soviet Union invaded Finland, and with almost no substantial help from allies, Finnish troops managed to drive the Soviets back, ultimately ceding just over 10% of Finland's landmass. But Finland's leaders were keenly aware the Soviets wanted more territory. In the face of an existential crisis, Finland had to get real and figure out what it was willing to sacrifice to preserve its remaining independence. Nearly 80 years later, that border has held. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Jared Diamond is professor of geography at the University of California, Los Angeles. Finland features prominently in his new book, Upheaval, Turning Points for Nations in Crisis, along with Japan, Indonesia, Chile, Germany, and Australia. In each case, these countries were faced with extraordinary challenges, and Diamond has been struck by the parallels between the factors that help nations withstand crises and the assets and skills that help individuals deal with traumas. He joins us now to talk about that. Jared, welcome to Think.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure to be with you.
What got you thinking about the parallels between nations in crisis and people who've lived through traumatic events like a nightclub fire in Boston in the early 40s?
What got me thinking is that my wife, Marie, is a clinical psychologist. In the first year of our marriage, Marie did a specialty training for psychologists, not in the usual several years of extended therapy where you can help the client explore early childhood events, but instead to help people in crisis, people who come in because their marriage has broken up, their child or spouse has died, they're facing a career or a health or a financial crisis. They recognize that their life just is not working. They got to find a new way of operating and doing it fast. So crisis therapy focuses on helping people within 6 weeks. Marie would come home once a week and tell me about the outcome predictors to help understand whether a person was or was not succeeding in dealing with a personal crisis. And as Marie talked about this, I realized similar factors, or factors that those suggest, also help me understand the outcomes of national crises in the countries where I've lived, speak the language, and know best. So that's the origin of the book.
So identity, personal identity or collective identity, can play into our capacity to deal constructively with crisis. Is that right?
That's right. Personal identity. Again, all of us know from the personal crises that we've all been through. It makes a difference whether you've got a sense of yourself, a secure sense of your own identity, or whether you're uncertain who you are or whether you depend upon other people for your identity. So a personal identity is important for helping resolve a personal crisis. Nations, of course, don't have ego strength, what a psychologist would say about personal identity. Of course, nations don't have ego strength, but nations do have something analogous, namely national identity. The U.S. has its national identity. Finland had its own national identity revolving around the very distinctive Finnish language, a beautiful language that nobody else in the world speaks.
So I'm going to raise my hand and admit that I didn't know very much at all about Finnish history until I read your book. But for other people that might be in the same boat with me, why was Finland left to cope with the Soviet threat almost entirely by itself?
I'm going to raise my hand and place myself in the same situation as you when I visited Finland.
Oh, I appreciate
that. My first visit
that.
To Finland in 1959, I visited Finland for the first time, ignorant of Finnish history, knowing only because I was born in 1937 and grew up in World War II. I knew that the Finns had fought on the side of the Axis, the Germans, Italians, and Japanese. I didn't know why. What happened is that Finland shares a border with the Soviet Union. The Finnish border was then only 30 miles from the second biggest Finnish city of Leningrad, now St. Petersburg, and the Russians were understandably scared that the Finns might permit some powerful allies to attack Leningrad by way of Finland. So the Russians demanded that the Finns push back their border. But the Finnish defense line was close to the Russian border. The Finns could not afford to move back. The Russians never dreamt that the Finns would be so stupid as to fight a war against a country of 170 million, Soviet Union, when the Finns had 3.5 million. The Finns did fight back. They held off the Russians in a terrible war called the Winter War that cost the Finns 10% of their male population and produced the biggest child exodus in history. But the Finns, God bless them, preserved their independence, and they learned from it. They made a change. They realized they were going to have to deal with the Soviet Union. Finland, a liberal democracy, dealing with an autocratic state, the Soviet Union. They succeeded so well that Finland today is one of the richest countries in the world and a leader in technology. So that's an outstanding example of selective change.
So how did the Finns figure out what they were willing to sacrifice and where they were going to draw a hard line and say, no, this is not something we're willing to give up?
Good question. The Finns drew a line at independence and occupation. They were unwilling to be occupied by the Soviet Union. They were unwilling to give up that border area because with the loss of their defense line, Russia could then walk in and take over all of Finland. The Finns were willing to die in large numbers to maintain their independence. And so they fought the Russians to a standstill. The Finns were very well prepared for a winter war. They fought on skis. The Russians were confined to roads, the Finns on skis, ambush Russian columns, and the Finns held off the Russians for nearly 4 months. It was incredible. Great loss to the Finns, but they preserved their independence.
What rises to the level of crisis from the standpoint of a nation in modern history? Was it easy for you to sort of decide where you could find crises in the countries that you, as you say, just happen to know well based on your work and your travel?
It was easy because when I look back on the countries where I've lived and where I speak the language and where I've been operating for 60 years, Finland, Germany, Indonesia, Chile, Australia, and Japan, where we have relatives, all of those countries had obvious crises that the countries recognized. They were invaded, like Finland. They were threatened with invasion. Japan, they had coup d'etats. Indonesia and Chile, they had big, slow changes in national identity, Australia and Germany. All this may make you think that it's for a country, for Jared Diamond to live in that country is bad news because it's going to mean a crisis. But the fact is that most countries experience crises over the course of a century or so. And this illustrates that what's called correlation does not prove causation. The correlation of Jared Diamond living in a country is not the cause of the country entering the crisis.
You know, you mentioned that there have been crises over time. I wonder if a country like the United States, could we be said to have overreacted to some negative events because we haven't had a crisis of the magnitude of some of the places that you've written about?
That's a very interesting question that taps into a number of things. The United States today, I would say we are spiraling into a crisis. We have not had an acute crisis, as did Finland, attacked by the Soviet Union. We did have the World Trade Center attack, with which we dealt more or less. But what you say illustrates that crises can be abrupt, as the Finnish invasion, or as Commodore Perry with an American fleet arriving in Japan in 1853 and forcibly opening Japan, but crises can also be slowly developing crises, like Australia's gradually recognizing that Australia is not a outpost of loyal British subjects that happens to be close to Asia, but Australians gradually changed their national identity. Germany also gradually changed its identity after World War II. And this illustrates, again, the parallels between personal crises and national crises. Some of our personal crises abrupt overnight. When you're a child or your spouse gets killed, that is a recipe for a quick crisis. But some of our crises unfold slowly. And so crises can either be gradual or erupting.
So for the Japanese, it must have felt like an overnight crisis when U.S. ships started amassing in Tokyo Bay in the mid-19th century.
It was an overnight crisis. Japan had closed itself off to the outside world since about the 1630s. The military governors of Japan, the shogun, did not permit foreign ships to visit Japan except for Chinese and Dutch traders on one island in Nagasaki Harbor, and correspondingly Japanese were not permitted to travel outside of Japan. And so when a U.S. fleet of steamships with cannons, Japan's ships were neither metal ships nor steamships, nor did they have cannons. When an American fleet under Perry sailed uninvited into Yokohama Harbor and said, "We're not leaving until we get a treaty whereby you will look out for shipwrecked American sailors," the Japanese recognized that they had a crisis overnight because they could not resist. They had to learn fast how to be able to resist the West, and that was going to take decades, but they succeeded very well. And so Japan in the 19th century is perhaps the outstanding example in the modern world of a country that made selective changes but maintained other things about itself, such as speaking Japanese and using kanji and having the emperor. Japan is this outstanding example of selective change modernizing to the point where Japan could resist the West.
One of the things that Japan did was immediately start this sort of fact-finding tour of the West, which is a pretty extraordinary thing for a nation that had been so closed off.
It is. Yeah, as you say, after Japan had been closed off, once the Japanese had a small, not very bloody revolution, which threw out the shogun and established a new government, bringing back supposedly the emperor as figurehead, the Japanese immediately sent out a fact-finding tour that went to the United States and European countries to find out how European nations dealt with fundamental problems of government and of courts and other things. But this illustrates the parallels between personal crises and national crises. When we have a personal crisis, most of us will go out and talk with friends about how they dealt with a crisis. When my first marriage broke up, within the next few days, I talked with five friends whose marriages had either gone on the rocks or had actually ended in divorce. And on the one hand, I got emotional support from my friends, but on the other hand, I learned from my friends how they had dealt with problems of failing marriages, just as the Japanese learned from the West how to deal with westernizing their governmental institutions.
So is there a similarity in the way nations that have gotten themselves through a crisis successfully tend to think about themselves differently afterward?
Interesting question. How do they change and how they think about themselves afterwards? A couple of things. One is, to get through a crisis, you need to make changes. And so you think about yourself afterwards in a different way from how you think about yourself before. Australia, after its crisis, its identity crisis, Australians now think of themselves as their own country out there in Asia rather than loyal British subjects. So that's one change. Another change with crises is that, having gotten through a crisis, you develop more confidence from having gotten through a previous crisis. So, for example, Britain today wrestling with Brexit, there are still British people who remember the Battle of Britain in 1940, when Britain alone faced Hitler's Luftwaffe and fought off the Luftwaffe. The British, we got through that, we fought off Goering and the Luftwaffe. We got through that so we can get through anything. Having gotten through a crisis before gives you confidence that you get through a current crisis. And again, that's something we know as people. Having gotten through a previous crisis, you're more confident you can get through a future one.
Jared Diamond is professor of geography at UCLA and author of the new book, Upheaval, Turning Points for Nations in Crisis. Welcome back to the conversation. In 2 minutes, you can join us by calling 800-933-5372.
Support for Think comes from ArtCan, a program of the Texas Cultural Trust and Houston Endowment, whose 2019 State of the Arts Report finds the arts contribute more than $5.5 billion annually to the Texas economy. More at artcantexas.org.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Jared Diamond. He's professor of geography at the University of California, Los Angeles, and author of the new book, Upheaval, Turning Points for Nations in Crisis. If you'd like to join us, you can call 800-933-5372. Okay, Jared, I want to go back for just a minute to Japan. We sort of finished the last segment talking about how for individuals and for nations, what doesn't kill us often makes us stronger. In the case of Japan, though, it would seem that some of the lessons they learned after the unbidden arrival of American warships were forgotten in the lead up to the Second World War. So what was forgotten that caused the Japanese to be so aggressive?
Yeah, after Japan's response to the arrival of the American warships and Japan's rapid modernizing, industrializing, developing a fleet, army, adopting Western-like institutions while preserving its emperor, Japan fought two wars with European countries, a colonial war with Germany, before that a very bloody war with Russia. And from the Russian War, the Japanese learned the wrong lesson. They learned that they could defeat a Western country. They learned that the way they did it was an unannounced attack, sinking Russian battleships in harbor. And the Japanese drew the lesson that in the 1930s, the way to face Japan's economic problems was to expand, even against the resistance of the United States. The Japanese felt that since we defeated Russia, we can defeat the United States. And ultimately, the way to do it is an unannounced attack on Pearl Harbor. The result, of course, was disastrous. The attack on Pearl Harbor guaranteed that the United States would stay in the war for as long as it took and would do everything to defeat Japan. And the industrial power of the United States was too great for Japan to overcome. So that's a case of a country learning some correct lessons, but also learning a wrong lesson from a crisis. We know that in our personal lives. You may draw the wrong lesson as well as the right lessons from a crisis.
So living in a country that has enjoyed political stability for a given amount of time can make it seem as if that place can't be vulnerable to upheaval. Chile is a good example of this. What happened there to allow a terrifying dictator to seize control for 17 years after decades of democratic rule?
Chile, for us Americans, is the most frightening case that I discuss in my book, Upheaval. It's upsetting because Chile is the most democratic country in Latin America. I lived there in 1967. When I moved there, my Chilean friends told me, the visiting American, we Chileans, we're not like those other Latin American countries that have military coups. We are democratic. We've been democratic for a long time. We know how to govern ourselves. That's what they said in 1967. But Chile was undergoing breakdown of political compromise, which 6 years after I lived there in 1973 resulted in a military coup d'etat, a military dictatorship that stayed in power for 17 years and smashed world records for sadism and torture. If it happened in Chile, we have to worry, could democracy in the United States also be a threat today? It's not going to end as did Chile with a military coup d'etat. Instead, if democracy ends in the United States, it will be by a continuation of what we're seeing now, namely restrictions on the ability of Americans to vote and decreasing number of Americans who bother to vote anyway, a breakdown of political compromise.
All right, let's talk about Germany. It was responsible for such extraordinary suffering before and during World War II, and it found itself literally divided. Why was it so critical for Germany to officially acknowledge its role in genocide when that was apparent to the entire world already?
It was apparent to the entire world that, yes, that Germany had carried out the Holocaust, the genocide after World War II. Why did Germany have to acknowledge it? Germany has acknowledged the Holocaust pitilessly. German school children, you know, I have close friends in Germany for having lived there. German school children, they learn about the Holocaust in schools. They're taken to concentration camps, ex-German concentration camps, to see the exhibits there. They're encouraged to go visit Israel and talk firsthand with Jewish survivors. Why was it important to Germany? There was a huge payoff. Germany was divided after World War II between a Western zone, West Germany, and the Eastern Zone, occupied by the Soviet Union, Communist East Germany. There was no way that either Russia or, for that matter, France or Britain or the United States would tolerate Germany's getting reunified as long as they were scared of Nazism coming back in Germany. But Germans being so open, so pitiless about acknowledging the horrible deeds of the Nazis, convinced French and Russians and Poles and British that the Germans had learned and they were not going to do it again. And the result was that Germany was permitted to reunify. That never would have happened without Germany's acknowledging what it had done in World War II.
So one of the things you explained that is very important in times of crisis is for individuals or societies to take an honest measure of what their problems actually are, what they're good at, what they value. It makes perfect sense, Jared, but it's worrisome given the state of 21st century America when we can't even agree on whether the news is real or fake.
It is worrisome. It's worrisome to us in our individual lives as well as in our national lives. You all know from your own experience that if you see a person with a problem and the person denies that the problem exists, of course they are going to get nowhere towards solving it. The United States today, the U.S. faces big problems, problems of this breakdown of political compromise, problems of inequality, problems of government underinvestment. But many Americans, including, I regret to say, some government leaders, deny what our problems are. Leaders of our federal government today emphasize what those Chinese and those Mexicans and those Canadians are doing to the United States. But there's no way that Chinese, Mexicans, or Canadians can end democracy in the United States. The only people who can end American democracy are Americans. And this, then, is a flagrant breakdown of honest self-appraisal on the part of American government leaders.
What about Russians? Can they end American democracy?
Can Russians end American democracy? No, they can't end it. They can contribute to it by obfuscating our elections. But on the other hand, in a democracy, we can see what Russians are doing to obfuscating American elections. The only people who can prevent Americans from voting are other Americans, American local governments and American state governments. Russians cannot prevent Americans from voting.
The unwillingness to compromise is an interesting thing to find in this book, is something that really worries you about the state of the U.S. today. It seems like a sort of a social problem to the extent that it's bothersome to people, but not necessarily an existential threat. Talk about why you think it might be.
It should be. It should not just bother people, but it should be recognized as an existential threat. All of us who've had experience of relationships, if in a marriage people do not compromise about essential things, if a husband and wife have different views about children or in-laws or money or religion, and if they can't reach a compromise, the marriage is doomed. Well, for a country as well, the American government to function, a democracy has to have compromises. Where there are disagreements, you have to reach a compromise that will satisfy the minority so that you don't have a chronically frustrated, rebellious minority. You can't, on the other hand, have a majority that imposes a tyranny. Throughout American history, we've done reasonably well about compromising, with the exception of the Civil War. Sometimes it takes a long time, but we've reached compromises. Within the last 25 years, political compromise has been declining in the United States in obvious ways. More and more filibusters in the last 20 years than in all the previous 200 years of American history, more cloture of filibusters, more refusals of the Senate to approve even low-level presidential nominees, more conflicts between the legislature and the executive, more conflicts between both of them and the courts. For example, the legislature of West Virginia has impeached every sitting justice on the West Virginia Supreme Court. That's a breakdown of compromise within the branches of government, between the two parties, and between state and local and national governments. To me, that's the biggest problem facing the United States today, the only problem that can end democracy, not by a military coup — we're not going to have a military coup — but instead by progressively the ability of Americans to vote getting eroded, because democracy depends upon voting.
All right, let's go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Bill is calling us from Dallas. Hi, Bill.
This is a fascinating program. Thank you.
Thank you.
My question relates to the crisis in countries and the effect it may have after the crisis on education. I know Finland is the best in the world in education by many measures. Is that a common experience?
Is that – good question, Bill. Great question, Bill. Is it a common experience? I wish it were a more common experience. Countries that get through crises, some of them have ramped up their educational systems. Finland, as you say, Bill, Finland has the best educational system in Western Europe. When you look at performances of school kids around the world, the top school kids around the world are in five Asian countries, and the only European country with top performance of school kids is Finland. Why? Because in Finland, people who want to study to become school teachers, they have to graduate university with top grades. They get high-paying jobs with high prestige. A Finnish school teacher enjoys more prestige and, I think, a higher income than a Finnish university professor. So, not surprisingly, the best university students in Finland become teachers. Finnish kids get great teaching, and the result is that this small country of what is it now, 6 million people, is near the top of the world in technology. Other countries that have done very well ramping up their educational systems, South Korea, a prime example, South Korea as well, Bill. In South Korea, it's the best university students who become teachers, and Japan, again, has great teachers. Whereas in the United States, sadly, the pay and the prestige of our school teachers is rather modest, with the result that we Americans, we educate very well 10% of our population, and we're not providing good education to the other 90%. Great question, Bill.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. If we are still the wealthiest country in the world, Jared, where is all our money going if it's not being reinvested in our own prosperity in the form of properly educating Americans?
Very good question, Chris. So the United States is the richest country in the world. Where is our money going if it's not going into educating our kids and maintaining the health of Americans? Well, American money is going in many directions. We have the world's biggest military. One can say, well, Western Europe is also rich. Why isn't Western Europe spending money massively on its military rather than hiding behind the shield of the United States? We're spending money on military. Shockingly, we're spending money on prisons. The percentage of the U.S. population imprisoned is higher than in any other first world country. There are many American states that spend more money on prisons than on education. And what on earth can you imagine is going to happen to our educational system? We're spending more on prisons than on education. So those are a couple of things on which we're spending lots of money, especially military, prison system. We're spending lots of money on health care, but without happy results, because the American health care system is expensive because of our private profit-making insurance and because of incomplete government support for health, whereas in European countries, everybody gets national health insurance and it's part of what every citizen is entitled to. So the United States, yes, we're the richest country, but sadly, we're not putting a fair share of our money into education and things that we need.
All right, back to the phones now. This time we have Ralph on the line in Austin, Texas. Hi, Ralph.
Hi. Mr. Diamond, first I wanted to mention that I thoroughly enjoyed your book, Guns, Germs, and Steel. I thought that was a very, very interesting take on history, and that it explained a lot. The my question in Stephen Brill's book, Tailspin, that you may be familiar with, he makes the case that a lot of the shift of money in the last 50 years away from the middle class and the lower classes has been due to the fact that the very, very best schools in the U.S. Educated some of the brightest people, and now we have essentially financial instruments for the sake of financial instruments, that they outsmarted Congress in the process, and that because Congress essentially wasn't bright enough to see what was going on and turn things down. Do you see that as a crisis the way that he does, and do you see a potential way that the U.S. may address that?
Thanks for calling.
Ralph, that illustrates why I find it wonderful to do conversations like this, because you tell me things that I hadn't learned. I haven't heard the view that we have such highly educated people that they are smarter than Congress and they can outsmart Congress. I hadn't thought of that. Maybe it's true. At the same time, Ralph, I would say that there are other things that are contributing to the problems of U.S. education. Other things are the decrease in government spending overall, not just for education, but for public good, for roads, for infrastructure, for health, an increasing view, a view among many Americans, particularly more conservative Americans, that if people are poor, it's their own fault, it's because they're lazy, they don't work hard enough, not recognizing that if a person is poor, a big part of the reason why they're poor is that they haven't been educated and they can't get a well-paying job. So I love your idea that you mentioned, Ralph. I see other ideas as well that contribute, and I'm trying to avoid breaking down into a chuckle over the phone because your idea is such a cute idea.
Do nations require unusually great leaders to lead them through crises?
Big question, the role of leaders to get through crises. Do they require unusually great leaders? Sometimes there are great leaders who had a big effect either for good or for bad. Winston Churchill gets credit for having led Britain through World War II. Franklin Roosevelt gets credit for the United States. At the opposite side, Adolf Hitler gets all the credit for having precipitated Germany into disaster.
Let me have you take a break here for 1 second. We have to take a break, and I want to make sure you have plenty of time to answer. So forgive me for interrupting. My guest is Jared Diamond, professor of geography at UCLA and author of Upheaval, Turning Points for Nations in Crisis. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes. Chris Boyd, and my guest this hour is UCLA professor of geography Jared Diamond. His newest book is Upheaval, Turning Points for Nations in Crisis. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 800-933-5372. Right before the break, Jared, you were about to tell us about how important leaders are in a moment of crisis.
Yes, we were talking about some leaders who clearly were important and unique: Winston Churchill, Franklin Roosevelt, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln. But one of the interesting things about American history is that most of our presidents, even if they didn't look very distinguished before coming to office, nevertheless did a decent job. A prime recent example is Harry Truman, who had an undistinguished political and business career. But when he became president, Harry Truman was faced with really difficult decisions: the ending of the war with Japan, the Berlin airlift, the beginning of the Korean War, the beginning of the Cold War. Truman historians generally recognize, despite his undistinguished beginnings, lived up to the challenge. And most American presidents, James Polk is another outstanding example, most American presidents were equal to the task, even if they had not seemed to be great leaders before that. And there were only a few American presidents, maybe three or four, who were recognized as failures.
So does that mean that if we love or really don't care for a particular leader, we might be okay? Things might not go as badly as we imagine they might?
Big question. I would say it depends upon how difficult is the challenge. The harder the challenge, the more closely balanced are the opposite views, what to do about it, the more important it is to have a very effective leader. And certainly, we Americans cannot coast along and say, who cares who is president, who is senator, we'll muddle through. Nowadays, with the problems facing the United States, we need great leadership.
All right, let's go back to the phones at 800-933-5372. Lou is on the line in San Antonio. Hi, Lou.
Hi. I just had a question. Mr. Diamond, I was just really curious. It's kind of a loaded question, but going back to the democratic process and, you know, how we vote and everything like that, and just in general, as someone who studies history quite a bit, it does bother me that history does have to repeat itself quite a bit, and we always do have to get to those crisis points to usually have to want to change something. But is there anything within your travel or, you know, knowledge that we can do to change something before it actually gets to that crisis point?
Hmm.
Because one thing that does usually bother me is, why does it always have to get to a crisis?
Thank you so much for calling.
Great question, Lou, and let's map that onto our personal lives. Why is it that we often need a crisis to get us to shape up? Why, when you have a deteriorating marriage, does it not happen until the wife or husband says, I'm walking out and getting a divorce? Why does it take that to get the other member to recognize that the marriage is deteriorating? With countries as well, a crisis focuses attention that a slowly developing problem doesn't focus. The British author Samuel Johnson expressed this when he said, this is 18th century, so here comes the English language, depend upon it, sir, it focuses a man's attention wonderfully if he knows that he is going to be hanged in 2 weeks. All right. That illustrates that a crisis catches attention. But there are countries that have anticipated, acted in advance of crises. Prime example is Europe after World War II. Europe did not wait for World War III, but Konrad Adenauer and other European leaders recognized we got to do something before there's another horrible war. And so they set to work to lay the precursors for the European Union. That's an example. Another example, because I'm back recently from the country of Finland that I know well, is that the Finnish government has a crisis council that meets every month, and their job is not to wait for crises, but instead to imagine what crises might happen and how Finland will deal with them. And I have a friend who's on Finland's monthly governmental crisis council. When I met him, he happened to come from a meeting that month about what Finland would do in the case of a failure of the Finnish electricity grid. The Finns didn't wait for there to be a failure of the electric grid. Instead, that month they discussed what Finland would do if the electric grid failed. And so Finland and then the European Union are examples of countries that took action in advance of crises. Sadly, it takes a crisis to focus attention.
So Venezuela is not in the book that I recall. I wonder how closely you're following circumstances there.
Venezuela, I follow from the newspapers, but what people ask me, Jared, why doesn't your book say anything about President Trump? Why doesn't your book say anything about Brexit? Or now, why doesn't your book say anything about Venezuela? And the answer is, my book is a book. It's not a magazine article.
Hmm.
I sent it off to the press in 2017 when Venezuela wasn't on the horizon. I knew that whatever I said in 2017 about Trump and about Brexit would be outdated within 2 or 3 weeks and I would look really stupid. And therefore, I decided as a matter of policy, I was not going to discuss fast-moving current events like Trump and Brexit and Venezuela, because I hope my book will be in press for 30 years, in print for 30 years. But the problems of the United States that I discuss were there before Trump, and they'll be there after Trump.
Please know that my question did not imply a criticism. I was just wondering. will it be necessary for us to embrace an identity as citizens of the world rather than simply citizens of our individual countries or continents in order to deal with global crises like climate change and pandemics and the potential for the use of nuclear weapons?
Wow. Must we recognize ourselves as citizens of the world? Of course, yes, whether or not you use the term citizens of the world. People today have to recognize that we're in this boat together. If climate change cooks us, it's going to cook all of us. Climate change is an issue for Chinese who are really worried about it. It's an issue for Americans. It's an issue for Bolivians. The risk of a nuclear holocaust, if a war breaks out, say, between India and Pakistan, or between Israel and Iran, or between North Korea and the United States, it's not just that North Korea and the United States are going to get bombed. It's that the detonation of lots of nuclear bombs around the world is likely to cause what's called a nuclear winter, namely that the atmosphere will turn black with soot, photosynthesis will be cut off, and everybody is going to die. And so the problems that the world faces now, problems of inequality, the nuclear risk, climate change, they're problems that affect everybody, and we are, like it or not, citizens of the same world.
You identify freedom from geopolitical restraints as critical to nations that are looking to weather a crisis, but what does that mean for efforts to solve problems that don't respect geopolitical boundaries?
Freedom from geopolitical constraints is nice if you've got it, but if you don't have it, there's nothing you can do about it except be honest about it. The United States is relatively free of geopolitical constraints. On two sides, we've got the Atlantic and Pacific Ocean that protect us. On North and South, we've got two neighbors, Canada and Mexico, that are not threatening us with military invasion. So the United States has relative geopolitical freedom. Finland is at the opposite extreme. Finland has an 800-mile border with the Soviet Union. Finland will always have to be super careful with the Soviet, with Russia. And similarly, Germany has something like 15 neighbors. Germany is always constrained. But again, we know this in our personal lives. In dealing with problems, some of us have a lot of freedom. If you are single, you've got money, you don't have children, you don't have childcare responsibilities, you have more freedom about dealing with your career problems than if your career problems hit you when you are married and you have four children. But the fact is, if you're married and you have four children, somehow you got to deal with your career problems despite being limited by your constraints.
All right, back to the phones now. We have John calling from Austin. Hi, John.
Hi. Do you think the Americans faced an economic crisis similar to in 2008, similar to what Germany's faced in the 30s? That led to the election of a dictator like Hitler?
Thanks for calling.
Good question, John. So is the United States facing an economic crisis today, or did we in 2008, equivalent to what Germany faced that brought Hitler to power? Yes, the United States does have economic problems, but my perception, John, would be that the problems of the United States, while we have economic problems, they're not our biggest problems. They're not on a par with the problems of the United States in the Depression beginning 1929. They're not on a par with the problems that drove Germany into the arms of Hitler. Instead, the problems of the United States, they're ones that you know about. They're ones of increasing difficulties in voter registration, in low voter turnout, in inequality, in low mobility, in the increasing difficulty or impossibility of poor Americans to go from rags to riches, in low government investment in public purposes. Yes, I am concerned about our economic difficulties, but I'm more concerned, John, about these other things.
It seems to me that compromise was once a value that Americans embraced, and it's become really stigmatized. What do we do about that?
What do we do about it? God, what do we do about it? Compromise, it used to be recognized that For a democracy to function, you got to have compromise. For a marriage to function, you have to have compromise. In the era of when Ronald Reagan was president, the Democratic Speaker of the House was Tip O'Neill. O'Neill and Reagan were at opposite extremes politically, but they respected each other. O'Neill acknowledged that Reagan as president had the prerogative to propose, and that O'Neill in charge of Congress, it was his responsibility to bring Reagan's proposals to a vote, whether he liked them or not. And Reagan and O'Neill managed to agree on constructive compromises. Unfortunately, that has been declining in the United States in recent decades. It's a big, why is it declining in the United States? Is it declining? Is compromise declining in the U.S. worse than it is declining in Britain with Brexit or in Japan or in Europe? I have a chunk of the first of my two chapters on the United States about why I think that compromise is deteriorating in the United States. My view will be controversial, and I think rather than blow my explanation, I'll say that I think there are reasons why compromise in the U.S. has been deteriorating, why it's deteriorating faster than other countries, and what we have to do about it before it cooks us.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So, Jared, why write a book like this now? What can we learn from understanding relatively recent history?
What can we learn from understanding relatively recent history? Well, history, on the one hand, consists of lots of details. The United States is not going to be attacked on November 30 by a much bigger country. There isn't a much bigger country. But history involves repeated issues. History involves crises. History involves refusal to admit. History involves refusal to change. History involves being honest or refusing to be honest. History involves national identity. History involves pride in what you've accomplished previously. Those are all things that we can see in history. We have the opportunity to learn from history about how some countries have gotten out through crises successfully and why other crises have bungled it. There's no need for us to repeat the mistakes of recent history. We can learn from other nations, just as we as individuals can learn from other people, from our friends who are going through divorce. We don't all have to get through divorces, and not all nations have to succumb to crises.
Do we still share core values in the United States with one another?
Good question. We give lip service to core values of rags to riches. The reality is that rags to riches, for a poor person to become rich, is more difficult in the United States than in any other major democracy. But the day before yesterday, I was with my son, Max, at Concord Battlefield in Massachusetts, and I thought, I went there pessimistic about whether the United States can find unity. When I went to Concord, I thought, the United States has done great things in the past. Those are things about which we can unify ourselves. Why doesn't an American president have the vision to go to Concord Battlefield on April 18th and remind Americans what we did at the beginning of the Revolution? Why doesn't an American president go to Ellis Island? Why doesn't an American president use Independence Day to talk to Americans about what really makes America great, what it is that holds us all together? That's an opportunity for leadership that I hope an American president will exercise, but I don't see it happening yet.
Jared Diamond is professor of geography at the University of California, Los Angeles. His latest book is called Upheaval: Turning Points for Nations in Crisis. Jared, it's been great to speak with you. Thanks so much for making time for us.
Chris, thank you so much.
You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. You can subscribe to our podcast using any podcast app, or you can find it on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.